Hi, my name is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring a talk from our 2019 U Sports Fall Summit, available in full at fortheloveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, and sports leaders develop programs to ensure kids love their game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. Let's all work together to make sure the kids love what they play. Thank you. Hi, it's Glenn Mulcahy, your host for Love What You Play online events and podcasts. Our next guest is someone I'm really looking forward to chat with, Sean Fitzgerald. He is currently the national senior writer for The Athletic Canada, which I'll get him to explain a little bit about that. The former sports writer for the Toronto Star, and he has also been a writer for the National Post. He's a graduate of Ryerson University, holds a degree in arts and journalism, and has also been a volunteer coach of ball hockey, soccer, and ice hockey. What I really want to zero in on is his recent book that has, I was just amazed. I got an opportunity with Amazon Prime to read it while I was running a coach clinic up north. Before the Lights Go Out, A Season Inside the Game on the Brink. And we're going to do a deep dive both on the Hockey Canada challenges that we're facing in terms of declining or stagnant enrollment, rising costs, lack of inclusivity, but he also highlights one of the most iconic, probably if not the most iconic, WHL franchise, the Peterborough Petes, who have had more players go through their system and make it to the NHL, as well as a number of coaches. Really looking forward to our chat. Thanks for joining us, Sean, and I know we've got a hard stop in 55 minutes, so let's go.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
The first question I ask everybody is, what sports did you play as a kid, whether it be structured or unstructured?
I played a lot of unstructured. When I was a younger child, I'm still old enough to remember the outdoor natural ice surfaces, the baseball field near the house froze over with the help of a lot of local parents over the winters. I didn't play organized hockey till I was about 13, and the excuse my parents like to give is that I was an asthmatic before Ventolin inhalers were really popular. So there's not a lot of 7-8-year-olds back in the mid-80s that had Ventolin inhalers, so I couldn't play then. But yeah, I played house league hockey, and when I was in high school, I tried everything. I was on the football team, deep on the bench, and played rugby and badminton and volleyball.
A similar path, with the exception that my son has exercise-induced asthma.
Yes.
So he was on the inhaler right from the get-go. Finally started subsiding when he got to about 14, 15, but 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, he always had to bring it with him. And the other downside, he's also got an extreme allergy to peanuts, so it was like a double-edged sword. Couldn't have any of the snacks that most of the other kids were having. So great exposure to sports. And then fast forward to current, what led you to journalism? Why Ryerson, and why did you focus on journalism as a career vocation?
I'm not smart enough to do anything else. You've seen this face. This face can't be on television. You've heard this voice. This voice can't be on radio. I'm bad at math. Science scares the holy living hell out of me. There's not a lot else I was going to do. My great-grandfather was sports editor of the Toronto Telegram, the newspaper that ended up becoming the Toronto Sun.
Wow.
My uncle worked at Global. He worked at the Canadian Press. So maybe it was genetics, or maybe I just come from a long line of people who just aren't smart enough to do anything else.
Well, I disagree. I mean, I read your book. It's pretty smart. The way you've written it is very well crafted. So kudos. And it could be part of the genetics. And it sounds like everybody in your family was doing it. So it kind of trickled down, right? It's kind of like in the sports world. If you don't have the genetics to play at a high level, you're probably not going to get there as well.
Well, I mean, I don't know if genetics or whatever, but I know that my wife is the education reporter at the Globe. So I might make the medal podium in terms of top journalists in this house right now. Well, maybe the two kids might be above me, so I might be fourth. But yeah, no, I've definitely been around journalism my whole life.
Definitely humble. It's amazing. The most humble people are usually the smartest. So we'll flip that on the other side. So the volunteer coach, and just kind of tapping into the world that you've been in, what do you think the top three characteristics are of great coaches?
Oh my goodness, that's a great question. I mean, I think it really depends on the level. And that's one thing that I very, very quickly came to learn, both from listening to very smart people like Dr. Stephen Norris, who's a consultant with Hockey Canada, through my own studying, through reading things like the IP program, initiation program for Hockey Canada. I really think it changes with the level that you're coaching. That, you know, at the top level, you know, you take a look at somebody at the NHL, for example, it'd have to be tactics, it'd have to be sports psychology, it would have to be a bunch of different things. But I mean, to really generalize it and put the easiest point I can, at the youth level, I think there has to be the understanding that there is only one reason that kids play sports. Only one. And it's to have fun. And if you won't facilitate them having fun, what on earth are you doing? After that, you know, developing skills, being a good teammate, all of the things that we associate with sports at the youth level, the coach is a facilitator. The teacher is part of that. But if you don't create an atmosphere where they have fun, what are you doing?
Yeah, and sadly, because a lot of coaches have kind of taken it to the other extreme with the winning of all costs, it's become a very big problem, not just in Canada, which you highlight in your book, but in the hockey space, but globally in youth sports, 70% of kids are quitting by the age of 13 because of that reason. They're not having fun anymore and a lot of the other issues. So one of the reasons why I think we're going to have a great conversation. So do you think lifelong learning is important for youth coaches?
It's a really good question. I mean, I'm 4 full hockey seasons in it. We have an 8-year-old. He's a novice hockey out here in Ontario. Our 4-year-old daughter started hockey school on the weekend. So she'll be the future all-time penalty minutes leader for the Canadian Olympic women's team. So watch out. Let's say 16 years. We haven't taught her how to get the tinfoil on the knuckles yet, but I mean, for a 4-year-old, she did up her own fight strap. So that was a proud parent moment for us. I have stacks of books downstairs. And I'm not a special case. We're very fortunate that, you know, I'm an assistant coach with our eldest competitive team, if you want to call it that. So it's select hockey here in Ontario, in Toronto, one step above house league. And our head coach buys into everything I think that we're going to end up talking about here. But yeah, downstairs I have Hockey Canada guides for IP, initiation program. I have the Hockey Canada guidebook for novice. I have taken Hockey Canada courses over the summer, Development 1. I've taken Developing Defenseman. I've really tried to learn as much as I can. One, like we talked about, for developing skills, but two, trying to learn the best practices. So it could be little things like, you know, these little kids, they're little. I mean, they're not going to be little for very long, but, you know, small things like, you know, while you're describing a drill on the ice, rather than standing up tall, get down on a knee so you can look them in and, you know, make eye contact. Small things like that I wouldn't have known 4 or 5 years ago, I now make it a routine. So yes, I am not saying I'm an expert here, but I'm saying that I do try and spend as much time as possible, and it's busy. I'm a volunteer, learning to do as much as I can for these kids.
Yeah, I mean, it is the reality with volunteers that they have full-time jobs and we're not making a living. But one of the greatest analogies I got from someone a few years ago is the calling for coaches is not to make a living, but rather is to make a difference by developing youth into adults, because that's really what we do. That's the business we're in. But a lot of people see it as, let's try to get them to the NCAA and professional level, but 0.03% of the kids will get there. Most of them, if they get to senior level, like at 18 years old, we've done our jobs right. Sadly, a lot of them are pulling out even sooner than that. So doing a deep dive then in terms of your background, tell us a little bit about the Athletic and Athletic Canada and what your role is with them.
Yeah, I am the senior national reporter, which means I sort of cover a bit of everything across Canada. So I could do hockey, I could do basketball, I could do football, I could do just about anything, mostly because I don't have an attention span. And again, the smart thing, I'm not super intelligent, so I don't have the attention span or focus or expertise to focus on one sport. But I like telling a bunch of sports, stories about a bunch of sports, rather. So I could do a story about, you know, somebody who works in sports media and do a profile on that. I could, you know, turn around and, you know, do long form interviews with, you know, Stu Grimson, and I have one coming up with Tamo Solani next week. So a bit of everything. And the Athletic is now a multinational based in San Francisco with operations in Canada, the United States, and now in the United Kingdom. So it's really branched out. I think there's the last number I saw publicly was something like north of 400 full-time employees. So it's been a lot of fun to be a part of over these 3 years.
Is it going to, do you think it's going to be the evolution of the space? Because I know my wife used to work in the pulp and paper industry that contributed to newsprint. I still like opening the newspaper. Like we shared that, and I'll plug it right now so everybody sees it. That's the date that we're actually doing this interview. This full page blurb from one of his buddies, Scott Stinson, highlighted and focuses and plugs his book. So you know that it's kind of getting some national media attention. And that was kind of ironic. I knew that we were doing the interview after all the back and forth we did to line this up, and there's the full pager. That was pretty amazing. So let's talk about the book. A, what led you to write it? Because if you were with the Peets for the whole season, it probably took a while to do, no?
Well, I was unemployed at the time. This is the sob story. So it was August 2016, and it was a Saturday afternoon, and I was playing shinny at Maple Leaf Gardens, which is now part of Ryerson University. Great sheet of ice if you're ever in Toronto. Shinny with a bunch of friends, and you're wearing a helmet, skates, gloves, and a stick. Notably, not wearing elbow pads. So just because, again, nobody body checked me, nobody tripped me, I just fell, shattered my right elbow playing shinny. That was a Saturday. Sunday, I had surgery. Monday, I was discharged home. Tuesday, the Toronto Star called to say, because of downsizing, I was being laid off. So I was on the couch for about a month, recovering from the broken elbow. And when I came out of it, a friend of mine who worked for McClellan Stewart, which is part of Penguin Random House, asked me if I'd like to go for a beer. I'm like, well, as it turns out, I have a lot of time. So we went out and had a beer. And he sort of proposed the rough framework of this idea of what does hockey look like? And this was 2016. What does hockey look like in 2016 in Canada? And how might its relationship be changing? Because for years, we've been talking about things like, wow, hockey sticks are expensive, skates are expensive, things are changing. So it was to sort of see the impact of all of these things that we've been talking about for years and years and years. And what are some of the cumulative effects? So, you know, after a while, maybe after a couple of adult beverages, we landed on Peterborough as a place that might work as a stand-in, sort of to reflect, you know, a place where we could study the broader trends that are impacting all of Canada, but use it as a base, sort of like a little bit like Buzz Bissinger did for Friday Night Lights, where he based his work out of Odessa, Texas, yeah, and high school Permian down there. So we ended up on Peterborough. And then over the course of the next 3 years, we worked on this project to explore some of the broader themes about Canada's evolving relationship with hockey as it flowed through Peterborough, Ontario.
Yeah, and the tie-in with Major Junior with an iconic franchise like that, and then looking at minor hockey kind of coincide, that was brilliantly, well, like a back and forth, like a compare contrast. So what then, without giving away the whole book and copies, what are the top three issues that you highlighted in the book?
Oh, my. The thing is, it's kind of, Jordan Ginsburg, who's the editor, sort of put it this way, that it's kind of a kaleidoscopic book, that it does hop all over the place, that, you know, we hop into the Peets and the challenges that they're facing as an iconic brand in the Ontario Hockey League, and certainly in Central Ontario and Peterborough, playing in something that's very close to almost a literal barn. Like, it's an old arena. So while all these other teams are moving into these palaces, like the London Knights play in something that's basically a smaller size version of Scotiabank Arena, where the Maple Leafs play. Like, they're playing professional level hockey in a lot of these markets, and the Peets are still sort of left behind a little bit because they're in an old arena. And it's sort of an imperfect parallel, but it's still a parallel between, you know, hockey in Canada and junior hockey in Peterborough, that for years, the Peets said, hey, Peterborough, it's cold, so it's time to come on inside and watch the Peets. And for years, hockey, generally, run by well-meaning volunteers, would say, hey, Canada, it's cold. Come on in and play hockey. But over the years, Canada's changed. Yep. Tastes have changed. There's a lot of other things to do rather than going to see the Peets or rather than go play hockey. So this sort of looks at what are the Peets and what's hockey in Canada going to do now that these tastes have changed and they've got to play kind of a catch-up.
Yeah, you look at that, like the Major Junior would be more geared towards the entertainment factor and getting the season ticket holders to maintain and keep going year after year. Then the minor hockey system is not necessarily the entertainment. It's the attraction and the retention of getting kids into the game to begin with and then ultimately keeping them again. And that's where we face a lot of challenges where, you know, 11, 12, 13 years old. I went through it with my son. He's now 20. And we had some great years early on. Then we went to the really competitive years and it was like, whoa, what's going on? Like, it wasn't like what it was for me when I grew up. And then you mentioned early on about the cost, like $300 sticks. when he went from junior skates to senior skates, because he was playing at the AAA level, I was getting away with Sport Check skates at like $250. So I was getting a great deal. We go to the hockey shop to buy his senior skates. First time, they're size 6, $899 plus tax, so just under $1,000. I'm like, just for his skates, like it was cost. It's crazy. Like, where is it going to end?
And that's the thing. Like, that's just one part of the cost. Like, equipment's expensive, but that's just now one part of the cost. That, you know, at the ages of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, there are full week camps where you send your children to go and learn how to use the outside edge, to use the reverse pivot, to do all of these things. And then more than that, that, you know, there are goaltending coaches who will come out and work with your tight age players, your work with your goalies. And then there's pro skills instructors who will come and, in addition to your coaches, work with kids at practice. And that's not out of the ordinary now. So there are all these costs that add up beyond just the equipment. And then you have the tournaments. You have the softer costs of, you know, if you have a job, which you need to pay for hockey, do you have the flexibility to get out on a Friday? Because if your child has a tournament, guess when the tournaments start? They start on Friday. Do you have the ability to get out of work at 4 to get your child hockey practice across town at 5 on a Wednesday? Do you have the willingness to give up your weekends because you're going to be spending them in a rink? Like, do you want to not try skiing? Do you not want to visit other family? Do you not want to sit down? Like, hockey asks now so much at the very young levels that you either go from house league, which can be 4 to 6 hours a month, which is fine, but it's kind of like piano lessons, right? You do it once a week. And it seems like one step above that, all of a sudden you're drinking from the fire hose. And the notion of play seems to have disappeared and is now replaced by cost, both hard economic, like you mentioned with the cost of equipment, and also soft cost that we all almost, you know, if you're in the game, you almost take for granted as part of it. But it really is a lot, like what we ask of the families and the kids and the parents in terms of time commitment and investment.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the financial, you nailed on the head with the time. If you get into the competitive stream, which we were at for a number of years, minimum 5 days a week, because we got 2 ice times, 2 practices, 2 games, a dry land, then you add the travel tournaments, and the next thing you know, like, okay, 8 months of your life is just hockey, hockey, hockey. But then there's the infamous monster, and I know in Toronto, it was 3 years ago when they were going to roll out cross-ice hockey, and Corey McNabb was at a summit with me, and he shared this anecdote. You have 6 and 7 year old kids playing in a non-sanctioned league. They're playing 63 games a year that are 6 and 7. Like, that's crazy.
It's true, and I've seen it. And again, I'm not completely innocent in this, that, you know, for the last 2 years, our eldest child has played on the spring hockey team. Now, we shut it down after that, and we throw the, you know, so from the middle of May until the last week of August, we throw the bag in the basement and we don't touch it. But again, it's still May. I mean, we haven't played hockey. So I'm not saying that I'm perfect on this by any stretch. But yes, you do have that. You know, if you want to get into cross ice, we can talk about that. But yeah, it's the element of fun. They're on the ice a lot. And you think, well, you know, Rock Carrier, who wrote The Hockey Sweater, which is, you know, that short story about, we went to church and we thought about hockey. We went to school and we thought about hockey. They played a lot of hockey too. But what's the difference there? One is structured, one is child-driven play. You're out there because you want to be out there and it's fun and you're with your buddies. And you don't have adults out there yelling at you because you're not doing a tight enough turn around the cone, or that maybe you're goofing off and you're shooting the pucks against the boards. Like, so one is fun and one is structure. So yeah, there's a lot of time on the ice in Rod Carrier's version. And what we like to think about of hockey in Canada, like if you close your eyes and think, what is hockey in Canada? You'd like to think of, you know, a soft snow falling on a frozen pond and, you know, the backdrop of children's laughter playing on a pond. But they're out there having fun. It's not structured. We're now structuring them to death. Like, that we're structuring the fun right out of it. And I think that, you know, the modified ice program is a revelation. The tyke age, the initiation age, they don't play full ice. They don't play the full adult-sized ice. They break it up into thirds, and you have the children playing cross ice, sideboard to sideboard, and you divide it into three zones. So you can have a game going at one zone, so from the blue line in, sideboard to sideboard. You can have a game going at the other end, sideboard to sideboard. And in the middle, you have a water station and maybe coach running drills. And every 3 to 4 to 5 minutes, you rotate. So what does that mimic? There's no scoreboard. There's no coach yelling. The parents have problems yelling too because nobody's keeping score. So what it really does, I think, and I know that this isn't the official line, but well, at its best, what modified ice mimics is pond hockey. It modifies the best of what we love about hockey, that they're out there, they're goofing around, there's no whistles, there's no penalties, there's no offsides, there's none of that garbage. They're out there, they're shooting the puck, they're touching the puck, they're stopping the puck a lot if you're a goalie. You get all of the engagement you used to get out on the pond, and I think it's a way to introduce the fun back into the game at the youngest ages. I think that's one positive step in the right direction.
Yeah, and it's kind of a reflection. USA Hockey started down that path sooner than we did.
But the funny thing is, Canada developed it first. Hockey Canada developed this 30 years ago, but didn't mandate it until 2016.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know if it was the article or the book where I saw the reference. It's like 20 years ago they had this vision of getting this modified version, because we've kind of lost – we're losing ground at the national events. If you look at the World Juniors this past year, and I had the fortunate opportunity, and I never thought in my wildest dreams I'd actually be able to see a gold medal game live, because the cost of tickets normally are $1,500, $2,000. But because Canada didn't make it into that final, they were giving the tickets away. Like, I was like, you got to be kidding me. But it's been kind of that problem the last few years where we either have not advanced to the gold, with the exception of, you know, Connor McDavid year, or we haven't even medaled at all. And then it's, oh my God, the whole country's shutting down. Brett Sutter, when he coached that team, was it 2014 where they didn't medal? But he said right after that, and it has been a reflection, I've seen it firsthand, too much structure in the game, not enough creativity, not enough focus on skill, not enough focus on fun. Because we're losing a lot of these potential. I know a lot of really, really good kids that quit 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. And I asked them, why are you quitting? I'm not having fun anymore. But those kids potentially could have went on and played junior. So how do we nip that in the bud?
Well, and the other thing too is that, you know, kids who are being, and it sounds ridiculous that they're dreamed out of the game that young, but they are, is that if they're slower to develop the skill component, if they're slower to develop physically, because kids do develop on their own pace. You know, if you are drummed out of the game at 12, because say you're too small or you just haven't developed your skating stride or whatever, if you're able to stay in the game, what if by 16 you're 6'2" and the fastest skater on the ice? What if you're just naturally becoming a better athlete at 16, 17, 18? You know, there's a really fun example here in Ontario that, you know, the head of the Ontario Hockey Federation, which is, you know, part of Hockey Canada, it's one of the umbrella organizations, is Phil McKee, and he was a defenseman who was kind of drummed out of the game at 13, 14. He was 5'2", 140 pounds. He just physically couldn't, you know, assert himself like he wanted to in the position. So he kind of left hockey and went on. And all of a sudden, when he was in university, he's 6'4", 240. Uh-huh. And he's playing varsity volleyball. And he's like, you know, he's not saying he would have turned into the greatest defenseman. But it's just as an example that, you know, kids sprout. They grow differently. If they're in the game, hockey is losing out on just athletes, just good athletes, because it is such an early window sport. That, I mean, the conversation now, especially here in Southern Ontario, is about the growth of basketball and the growth potential of basketball. That, you know, with the Toronto Raptors winning the NBA championship, 7.7 million Canadians watched Game 6. And a lot of those are kids now who are getting interest in basketball. The real interesting thing about basketball is it's a late window sport, that you don't get drummed out of the game at 8, 9, 10. You can still enter it in junior high school, that you can really hone your abilities in high school. That, you know, take a look at Pascal, you know, Siakam and folks, you know, some of these folks on the Raptors didn't adopt it at 4, 5, 6, that they played later. And look what they've turned into. Whereas hockey, you know, if you're not getting pro skating instruction before grade 3, like, you might be pushed out of the sport, which is ridiculous. It sounds ridiculous to say, and it is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's almost like hockey is going the gymnastics model, right? Early, whereas many other sports I played, and we talked about earlier, you played a bunch of sports. I played football, rugby, baseball, soccer, basketball, volleyball, you name it. I skied. I taught myself how to ski, golf. I tried them all. But hockey was just one of those ones where, like, Jamie Benn, he just played it as like an off-season thing because he was more of a baseball player. But he's a great athlete, first and foremost. And that's what we're trying to get people to understand in the space. Like, your kid might be good at some hockey skills, but they end up becoming motor morons on the other skills. Like, the perfect example for the basketball world, Steve Nash. He didn't even pick up a ball until he was 13. And fast forward years later, he's the MVP in the NBA. Like, you don't have to be early. And basketball is one of those perfect examples. And I think because the Raptors had that success last year, it is going to really help Basketball Canada grow their game.
For sure. And I mean, at this point in the conversation, like, if you're watching this and you have a child who's in competitive dance or competitive swimming, a lot of this sounds very familiar to you. That the cost of competitive swimming are extraordinary. The demands of competitive dance are mind-blowing. Like, there's a lot that those sports, that those pursuits require, and they are wonderful pursuits. And they, again, getting your child physically active, getting them in a team environment, like, it's great. Competitive dance and swimming are wonderful pursuits, and they are exceptionally expensive and demanding at the competitive level. So, you know, you're right to say, well, you know, hockey's not alone. Why are you picking on hockey? Well, the reason we're picking on hockey here, and the reason that we focus on hockey here so much, is that hockey was on the back of our $5 bill for many years. That hockey used to be for all Canadians. Hockey was what tied so many of us together, that hockey was the accessible sport for so many for so long. And the reason that we're picking on hockey now is because hockey had never been like that, what it's become, with the money and the professionalization. And that's why we're taking a look and taking stock now at, you know, yes, it stands to reason that Canada's changing, and it's a very good thing that Canada's changing. And it stands to reason that as Canada changes, its taste will evolve. What we're doing here is taking stock of what hockey has meant and what this evolution might mean for the future of a country that has for so long identified itself with this sport.
Yeah, I can agree with you more, because my life revolved around it, because I was born and raised in Montreal. I started playing organized hockey much earlier than you did, as we had outdoor rinks, like literally every corner there was an outdoor rink, and they were maintained year round. But one of the big changes is climate change has made it difficult for those 5,000 plus outdoor rinks. We have more per capita than anywhere else in the world. But that's where I learned all the pond hockey. Right? Like, when there was no organizing games, we were just out there for hours and hours and hours. And then you think back of the Bobby Orr era, right? All those guys, they were all pond hockey guys. And it, what amazes me, fast forward 30 years and you look at the big outdoor events. The first one, I think, was with Theodore, and he had the toque on. It was,
yes, in Edmonton.
Right? In Edmonton, the first one. And I was laughing. I'm going, that was my childhood, playing outdoors in the snow. And the only thing that stopped us, we were hungry, or we had to go to the bathroom. And what did we do? We went back. We just kept playing for hours and hours and end. And you touch on it really early, the too much structure versus the lack of structure. And how do we find a happy medium where we can bring more of that free play back to the games? Like, I know cross ice is going, but are we going to get there fast enough so that we can keep kids in the game?
That's a really interesting question. And I've been thinking about that a lot recently. And I know that Tom Rennie's been focused on this too at Hockey Canada. And the really interesting thing is too, is that through the reporting process of this book, and there are more than, I think, 200 interviews, easily more, I think, that went into this, is that Minor Hockey Association executives across Canada identified that this is an issue. I didn't come across anybody, and have not come across anybody, who said that this, what we're talking about, that we're out to lunch, that there are significant structural issues that have to be addressed. The question is, what are the solutions? And what's the implementation going to look like, especially that, you know, every minor hockey association is different. It has different issues and challenges and demographics that, you know, could be things like storage space in your local arena, you know, in a city versus a suburb. All of these things come into play, and we can talk about it. But I really do think that it starts from the youngest age groups. And the idea of the initiation program, and I think taking the emphasis off the results early is a real important step. And in some parts of Scandinavia, children don't see a scoreboard for their games until they're 12 or 13 years old. And that's as much for the parents as anything. Like the kids know the score of the game. It might not be accurate, but they know if they're up 8-0 or 8-4 or 7-2 or 2-1. They know, but they get to play. They get to play on their own terms. It's not the parents who are yelling and banging on the glass. It's not the coaches who are yelling themselves hoarse about getting back in the proper defensive zone positioning. And again, as an assistant coach on a competitive level team, I'm not perfect. But that's me. I'm admitting that I'm not perfect. I try not to do that, but it's just part of it. So de-emphasizing outcomes is key. Emphasizing free play and that pond hockey mentality, which is what modified ice does so well, especially at the introduction ages, 4, 5, 6, where they're just out there and they're just able to play. And it goes up to novice when you go to half ice. You know, most associations now maybe put boards in the middle along the red line. And for the older kids, they go half ice. So red line to goal line, basically. I think emphasizing that and finding ways to move that up through the age ranks, to make it fun. And through the coaching materials, to really hammer at home that, you know, as you develop skills, there are fun ways to develop those skills to still make it seem like a game. Like, just as a quick aside, this is from some of Hockey Canada's materials, but this is a drill that I've used, honestly, for probably 3 or 4 years now. And we're in novice hockey, so they're 8 or 9. And I will report back when they start getting tired of this one. But do you remember the TV show American Gladiators?
Yeah.
From the 80s and 90s?
Yeah.
So there was a game. So American Gladiators contestants would do a whole bunch of different competitions and try and win. There was a game that was usually the end. It was sort of like... you know, the Price is Right, sort of like the showcase showdown of American Gladiators, where there was one gladiator at the barrier trying not to get hit with these tennis balls. So they duck in behind a bicycle or a barrel and try and get close enough that they could finally tap something at the end of the barrier, at the end of the race, and they win. So Hockey Canada had an idea for a game. And what it is, you know, you as a coach are standing beside the net and there are pylons. So the kids start in the far corner, and they zigzag around one pylon, zigzag around another pylon, zigzag around a fourth pylon, pick up a puck, come in around another pylon, and shoot. Simple, right?
Yep.
What do? You have a bucket full of tennis balls beside you as a coach, and as the kids are zigzagging, you fire gently tennis balls at the kids. And if you hit the kid in the shin pad, the kid's out. But the kids are trying to duck and dodge. And what they learn without even knowing it is, when they duck down, maybe they're ducking down on the side, so they're using their knees and they're you know, working on their outside edges. They're working on keeping their heads up all the time on a swivel. So even when they have the puck, they don't want to get hit by the tennis ball. They're all of a sudden stick handling without looking at the puck. So you're working on things like agility, bending, recovery, inside edge, outside edge on the blades, all without them having a clue that they're working on it. But they are laughing, because they're looking at kids who are getting, you know, pinged with tennis balls on the knee. They're ducking. They're celebrating when they get through. You know, they get to look at their parents' faces horrified, especially if they haven't seen this drill before, that coaches are firing. I mean, they're fully padded and you don't shoot it hard. But it's fun. They love it. And it's messy and it's fun and it's loud. And they're working on all of these skills. And it is so important to maintain that outlook, I believe, for as long as you can, that there's always something fun in a practice. Not everything can be fun. Power skating is a necessity, and you know what? It can kind of suck, but there's other ways to work around it and maintain in an hour-long practice and 45, 55 minutes on the ice that there's something they're going to be looking forward to.
Yeah, I can agree with you more. I mean, that's the way I've always coached. I've always had cheery time at the beginning, cheery time at the end. Brian, you gave a great example of the tennis ball drill, which you can call it asteroids, whatever the case may be.
That's a good one too. And there's other ways, like they shoot the cones. And it's all in Hockey Canada's manuals. Like, Hockey Canada is, to its eternal credit, providing these examples. Yeah. It's just a matter of getting them into the hands of coaches who then understand the importance of adopting some of this stuff.
Yeah, but most of the coaches, even the 6, 7, 8-year-old kids that are now frustrated that cross ice is now part of the metric are still thinking systems, tactics, strategies, right? Power play, penalty kill. Like, hang on a sec. You shouldn't be introducing that until way down the pipeline. Like, you should be focusing on the core skills all the way through. And we kind of touch on a couple things. Sweden is one of those Scandinavian countries that does not compete until the 13th. They focus on skill development, but the big thing, and it's in their video, that's just kind of the secrets of Swedish hockey, and if you want the link, I can send it to you. They melt their ice on April 1st until the end of August. There is no such thing as spring hockey in Sweden, but yet there's been some pretty good players that come out of there. Would you agree?
I think that's pretty fair, yeah.
Yeah, there's some pretty good players. Recently, there's one that's played for the Canucks that won the Calder Trophy last year.
Basically familiar with that work, yes.
Around on hockey, but yet they're generating. I heard a statistic. They have more players per capita in their country that made it to the NHL than any other country, which I thought was amazing.
And that's great. But, I mean, for coaches and for parents, I think we have to get away from, yes, developing is important. But what are you developing for? Like, you're developing good beer league players. Like, that's what you're developing. You win a medal as a coach. You get your trophy 20 years after these kids come through your program. And you get an email back because they want a beer league trophy because, you know, their accounting firm has a team entered in the beer league and they're still playing because they love the game. That's your trophy. That's how you win as a coach or as a parent of a youth player. Making them the next Elias Pettersson or making them the next Connor McDavid, sure, maybe, whatever. You win if they have fun and they learn to love the game. Because it does. It offers so much. We've spent, a half hour talking about so much that's wrong with hockey, and there is. But the things that are right with hockey, the things that it still offers, we don't really fully appreciate, because I think if you're in the hockey bubble, you take it for granted that, you know, just as an example, last year, our little guy goes to school here. He was in grade 2. And the first day of school, there's a little kid who's wearing a Vancouver Canucks hat in class. And he's new. His family just moved here from Vancouver. So the teacher knows that our guy is nuts about hockey. So she sits this little Vancouver Canucks fan next to our little guy. Before morning recess, they have the conversation of, I like Brock Besser. I like PK Subban. I play for the East York Bulldogs. I'm going to play for the Tedry Thunder. Are we going to be best friends? Yes. So they have that connection. So what happens? Well, that little boy's dad is now part of my beer league hockey team. Boy has a little sister. The girls get along well. They both now like, you know, hanging out and, you know, will eventually play hockey together too. That connection from all of the provinces and all of the kilometers that separated our family from their family 2 years ago have evaporated because there was a common thread of hockey. Now, might they have found each other, you know, because of their other interests without hockey? Maybe. But you know what made it really easy? Hockey brings communities together, and it repeats itself over and over and over. That I live in the most populous city in all of Canada, and because of hockey, because you meet the literal butcher, baker, candlestick maker, and you're all drinking terrible arena coffee all winter long, leaning over the railing, you meet each other, and it becomes a small town. And think of how often that plays itself out over and over and over. And imagine how much better that could be if we made this game more accessible and made it more fun and made it clear why it's so fun to all of the people who can't access it or who don't want to access the game right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, one of the big benefits for me when growing up with hockey, coming from Montreal, but then we started moving around the country. I was in the Northwest Territories on Frobisher. Well, I can't remember what they've changed the name to, but on Baffin Island, like way up north, and they had a hockey rink. So I got to play hockey when I was like 6 years old or 7 years old. Then I moved to Ottawa, a hockey rink. Then I go to Toronto, hockey rink. And Ottawa had Rideau Canal, then Vancouver. So I played hockey all across this country, and the one constant was the community that it basically intertwined. Now, that was many years back, and where I was going through the book, I'm seeing the erosion of those communities. And part of that is because of the travel focus with a lot of you're with an elite team, or I don't believe there's a word elite should be even used in until the kids are at the Olympics. That's just my take. But let's call it AAA, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
But the big focus on the travel/prospect teams. That to me is what's really been the radical shift that's taken away from the community. Like even in BC, we're going to zone boundary teams and all kinds of stuff. So we've got major midget, you've got academies, you have the minor, and then you've got the zone. Like, where does the kid become a friend? Like your son and his buddy, how long is that going to last if they end up being on two separate travel teams?
No, and that's the thing. I really do think, and the really tricky thing here is, as you, if you're a minor hockey, you know, executive with some pull, is how do you address the professionalization at the grassroots level? Because that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the professional coaching that can run a spring hockey program, summer hockey program, the camps, the money that flows through here. That, you know, here in Toronto, there's the Greater Toronto Hockey League, which, you know, is the largest minor hockey league in the world. Like I can't remember the number, it's something like
staggering how many teams and players are in it. Yeah.
Teams and players. And every year they have the OHL Top Prospects game, which is basically the best minor midget. So the Canadian Hockey League draft eligible aged players, they come and they play against each other. So top 30, 40 kids in the GTA come and play against each other. And it's at a rink called Scotiabank Pond in the north end of the city. I've gone to it 3 or 4 years in a row, just by nature of my job, but also for the book. And every time I go, I think they're going to call the police on me when I park my car, because somebody's going to go, why on earth is there a Honda Civic allowed to park in this parking lot? Because it's very clearly designated for Range Rovers, Porsches, BMWs, and Mercedes. Like, my car goes in there. I want to park very far away and walk, because you go into that lot and it is luxury vehicles everywhere. And then you go inside and you see that it's for the wealthy. The Terry Pekoski is a journalist for the Hamilton Spectator. And let's say 4 years ago now, she did exemplary work in a series for the paper where she emailed away to all the teams in the Ontario Hockey League and said, look, I don't want any personal information from your players. I just want the postal codes from their parents' address, just the postal codes. So she heard back from, I think, all but 4 or 5. And she ran that data through StatsCan, Statistics Canada databases. And what she found, and I'm going to mangle the numbers, but it's a pretty close proximity, I think, approximation. It's something like 80% of the kids in the Ontario Hockey League are from urban areas. And again, more than 3/4 of them within those urban areas are from wealthy parts of those urban areas. So the picture that emerges of kids playing, and you can use elite, I think, in junior hockey at that point. The picture of the child who makes it to the Ontario Hockey League is basically a well-off upper middle class city kid. That, you know, the kids that Tom Cochran sang about in Big League, about the only way out of the northern mining town was to be real fast and tough with the game, doesn't happen anymore. That's what's changed. It's the money, it's the professionalization. So the challenge is, and I wish we could sit here and solve this problem over this conversation of how do you address it, but you can't put that genie back in the bottle. Like, that's capitalism. The money's there, the parents with money will find ways to use it. So how do you fix that? How do you address that?
Yeah, and we're seeing that start to evolve in Canada, but because of the work I do and all the people I work with, I've seen this happen much sooner in the U.S. It's called the pay-to-play model, where more and more kids, if their parents are not making gross household income over $100,000, they're being deprived the opportunity to play sports, partly because of this travel phenomenon that has evolved. And U.S. data is youth sports is now a $17 billion, and that's U.S. dollar, industry, with well over $20 billion Canadian. Like, that's staggering. If we did the 10% rule coming into Canada, it's still staggering.
The New York Times did a wonderful story on this last year. There are entire sort of, I don't want to call them campuses, but that's kind of what they are in some of these towns in the U.S. where, you know, there's 4 baseball fields, 2 indoor ice pads, football fields all around this cluster of hotels. And they exist only to cater to these travel teams that, you know, you have a hockey tournament come around in February. That's where it is. Everybody's driving to that hotel and staying in those hotels and eating in those restaurants and competing on those ice pads. In the spring, that's where those dance competitions are, in those gymnasiums. That's where those baseball tournaments are being held, all in these massive campuses. there's versions of that. I mean, we have one scheduled in the winter north of Toronto, which is kind of a very similar thing. Like, and you can tell when, you know, these resorts or these hotels host a lot of hockey tournaments because they make you sign waivers before you check in saying, you know, you will not play mini sticks in the hallway. You will not play mini sticks in the banquet room, that your child will not run the hallways without adult supervision. Like you're not going to a hotel that's, you know, not familiar, hasn't done this dance before. Like, you can see where this is going.
Yeah, they leave it and breathe it because they want to keep the kids in control. They know they're going to be doing dry land and all this other stuff and the mini sticks. That's where you get the conference room. You always make sure you book a conference room at the hotel so you can actually...
Some of these hotels don't allow it in the conference room even when you book.
Really?
Yeah. Our team had to sign a waiver for the second tournament we did last year, and it was a Canadian one, and it was outlined that you will not do any hockey-related activities within the walls of these hotels.
You kind of can't blame them because they don't want damage.
Oh, 100% not, but it's to the point of what we're talking about, which is the travel has become so concentrated and so regular that, you know, entire regions of hotels exist only by the grace of, you know, hockey and sports-weary parents taking their kids from tournament to tournament all winter.
Yeah, that kind of precursors one of my last questions. We'll get in a deep dive. So what's your advice to parents that are caught in that trap where, you know, you've got a buddy that's playing on a spring team that's doing all these travel tournaments, and you're kind of like, I don't really think that's the best route to play. I'd rather you do lacrosse or golf or something in the off season to get away from the rinks so you come back fresh. What do you say to those parents?
I wish I had a better answer. Because I think, and I know that I'm going to be wrong here, but the old cliche of you think your kid's going to the NHL, like that's what you're pushing towards, that certainly still exists and you still see that. But I think that cliche is a cliche because it has been repeated so long. I really do think that a lot of parents understand now the percentage, because we have hammered it home. You mentioned it earlier. It's 0.003% of kids go on to play at the highest level. I think what it boils down to is that if you're a parent, you don't want to see your kid disappointed. Like, there's going to be enough in life that will beat you down that you don't need youth sports to do it. So what do? You're a parent. You want little Jeannie or little Johnny to stay with their friend group. You want them to go on to that double A team. You want them to do whatever. So if all of little Jeannie's friends are going to that hockey camp, you're probably going to want to send her along too, just so that she can keep up. Even though, you know, there are studies and there's science to say that eventually she's going to catch up anyway. And in fact, by not sending her to that spring or summer camp, you're doing her a better favor because she's getting away from the rink. So you don't have to worry about burnout or, you know, repetitive stress injuries to the hip or knee because you're doing the same movement all year round with the skating. Yeah. But it's really hard. And I just spent 3 years doing this book. And we have kids in the game. And I consider it a personal victory for myself that we kept them off the ice from May until August. But you know what? Probably should have kept them off from March until September. But again, it's not an easy answer because you want the best for your kids. And I'm not sure how you address this. And I know that, you know, people are talking about it, that, you know, here in the GTHL in November, they're holding a summit to address a lot of the issues we've spent, 45, 50 minutes talking about here. Mm-hmm. But it is something that has to be addressed. We cannot turn a blind eye to it because it is going to fundamentally alter how we relate to this game that for generations we have held as ours as Canadians.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, your whole title of the book, right? Before the Lights Go Out, the Season Inside, the Game on the Brink, we're at that crossroads. I believe, and I saw it coming about 5 years ago, that if we continue down this path, all we're going to have is, the professionalism, the adultification, the high-level hockey, and the grassroots, the house leagues that a lot of kids love and they just love to keep playing in the beer league. So the one of the things I say to a lot of parents is that, you know, if I do a clinic is, and you're still playing beer league, right?
I bring shame on the family name and on the game itself twice a week.
And so did I for a number of years till my knee just couldn't take it anymore. Oh. So two things that kids ask, and correct me if they ask you, after a game, number one question is, what's the snack? Yes or no?
True.
Okay. Last question before they leave the dressing room. Coach, when do we play again?
We don't hear that because usually what they're doing by that point is either trading Pokemon cards or trading hockey cards or playing tag. They're gone. Yeah, door opens, they are gone.
And they also were not really that concerned whether they won or lost, right?
100% not.
Five minutes, and then they kind of go, okay, we'll move on to the next game. You're playing beer league. First question you ask when you get in the dressing room.
Does anybody have any ice? My knee hurts.
Oh, that's the first question. What's the second question?
Or, oh my God, I can't breathe. Or, oh my God, why do I do this to myself? I'm so tired.
Because usually, and I played as long as I could, who's got the beer? How much is it? That's the snack. And last question that I would ask is, when do we play again? Because no one ever kept track of their schedule. So, and that really comes down as kind of a closing statement is what we need to do is we need to figure out a way, I believe, is to instill that love and passion for the game again so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. And when they're working the sport year-round, that's what's leading to the 12, 13-year-old kids that are pulling out, putting the white flags, said, I'm not doing this anymore because I'm not playing the sport anymore. I'm working it. Agree?
I think we just saved hockey, Clem. I think we just did it. As long as we can make sure that everybody knows that fun has to be the first, second, and third rule of hockey, and that everything else comes after it, that's how we get there. Now, what are the solutions and what are the practical applications? I have no idea. I mean, there are lots of interesting ideas floating around. Some of them are in the book, and some of them we can talk about next time we do this. There are ideas. The challenge is, how do you build the will to implement that change? And as you've seen with some of the resistance for things like cross-ice hockey, how do you create buy-in among not just the administrators, but the parents who drive the bus so often in this?
Yeah, I could agree with you more. That's the biggest challenge we're all facing in this space because they are the ultimate drivers of the ship because they're paying the bills. And we don't cater to the avatar of the customer, then, you know, we've got to educate them more so they understand the hurt that they're doing long-term. Because you probably wouldn't be playing if you didn't love it early on. I probably wouldn't have kept coaching if I didn't love it early on. Think about all those, that next generation of lack of coaches, lack of players. Then you're right, the lights do go out. So a couple of deep, just rapid fire questions. Other than your book, and I'm like, again, I'm going to say, make sure that you read this. This is a no-brainer. It's a must-read for me. What other books, as you've read a whole ton, would you recommend for parents or coaches in the hockey space or just youth sports that they should?
Oh, my. Youth sports books. Oh. As a coach, I've really had my eyes opened by – they're hard to find because that website's not easy to navigate, and I'm old school. I like the old-fashioned binders. But they do. They have coaching materials that I think if you're a parent – suits you just as well to read because it emphasizes a lot of the stuff that we talk about that, you know, you don't care whether your kid in Tyke wins that game in November 12 to 13, you know, 12, 11. It doesn't matter. Are they coming away from the rink having fun? Are they making connections? Are they having fun socially? Are they being physically active? Those are the things that should be the first and the second and third and fourth. The results don't matter. I read those things. I read the works of, you know, some of the folks who have put the time into that. I think Corey McNabb, Stephen Norris is very smart in that. And I think Tom Rennie has his heart in the right place. And now it's just a question of, you know, in something as broad as hockey in Canada, how do you possibly build a consensus? And, I mean, you mentioned it. Like, it sounds alarmist to say, and it is because it's alarming. But hockey really is at that crossroads now. No. Action has to be taken very soon.
Yeah, I saw it coming, not just with hockey. And that's one of the reasons I put my hand up 10 years ago to be a facilitator. So I go all over mainly the Lower Mainland, but I just came back from Whitehorse, as we shared before we got on the talk. Mm-hmm. The big difference, and the last takeaway, because I know we got 1 minute before your call, I was just in Whitehorse. I can tell you the small towns, they do generate some great players, but they love the game up there. I guess they don't really have much else to do way up north, like I did when I was in Northwest Territories, right? And they have passionate coaches, passionate players, but they have 3-1 practice to game ratio. We have 1-1, so we're way over competitive. So one of the quick fixes is if we can get rid of one of those games and turn it into a practice, you have a 3-1 practice game slot. That's just my take. No one will listen to me in Toronto, but maybe it'll happen somewhere else, because that'll fix it right then and there. And if we can ease the competition and introduce it later, I think that'll also help too. Agree or disagree?
I think the thing is there, if you're going to have 3 hours or whatever your practice allotment there is, you know, for 3-1, that's good, but you have to get buy-in for the coaches that those practices are going to be fun. Because if they're just skating drills, if they're 1971 Soviet style skating, you know, factories, that's not going to be fun. And that's not going to address the whole problem.
Yeah, probably the funnest drill I ever had, and I shared it when I was up in almost every clinic. I did the Safe and Fun Hockey with Cassie Campbell, Pascal, and Vicky. And Bobby Orr was supposed to come, so all these guys signed up. He never showed up, but we said, you know, we were with girls. There was one drill. It was, you know, the traditional puck race around cones.
Yep.
You chase to go get the puck. But instead of a puck, and coming back to your tennis ball analogy to finish this up, they put a rubber duck. And my job was to stage the rubber duck. So the kids go around the cones, and they jump down, they grab the duck. And then the girls had to basically take this duck and throw it over Vicky, who was the goalie. And like, can imagine that? Like, all they were doing was laughing the whole time. They had big smiles on their faces. I was like in tears. Vicky couldn't believe what was happening. What did they learn in that drill? Same thing you were talking about earlier, the balance, the agility, the edges, that passion, all that stuff that they would learn. Why? The drill was disguised. They didn't even think it was a drill. It was just a fun mini game. If we did a whole bunch of mini games,
that's amazing.
We'd fix the problem, right? So, thank you so, so, so much for doing this. That was a great chat. I got to talk for hours. And with this book, I'm telling you, I'm recommending it to everybody. Four guys in Whitehorse are picking it up. And they've probably seen it 3 months from Amazon.
Thank you so much, Glenn. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook for Love of the Game, Twitter, TLOTG Conference, and for loveofthegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.